Hi, I'm Amy Goodman. In this age of climate chaos and COVID-19, you count on Democracy Now! To stay focused on the issues that matter most. We count on you to support our independent journalism. If everyone who tunes into Democracy Now! Gave just $4, we could cover our operating costs for 2022. Really, that's all it would take. Please do your part today by visiting us at democracynow.org. Oh, and stay safe, wear a mask, save lives. Thank you so much, and happy holidays. From New York, this is Democracy Now!.
You're arguing that the Constitution's silent and therefore neutral on the question of abortion. In other words, that the Constitution's neither pro-life nor pro-choice on the question of abortion, but leaves the issue for the people of the states or perhaps Congress to resolve in the democratic process. Is that accurate?
Right. We're saying it's left to the people, Your Honor.
The Supreme Court appears set to uphold Mississippi's 15-week abortion ban in a move that could radically reduce abortion access across the United States and undermine the landmark Roe v. Wade decision. The court's three liberal judges warned reversing Roe would damage the court's legitimacy.
Will this institution survive the stench that this creates in the public perception that the Constitution and its reading are just political acts?
We'll hear excerpts from Wednesday's oral arguments and speak to Professor Katie Rogers and Planned Parenthood Federation of America Chief Alexis McGill-Johnson. Then we go to France, where President Macron has inducted American-born pioneering performer and civil rights icon Josephine Baker into the Pantheon. This comes as racism is on the rise in France with the far-right xenophobic writer Eric Zemmour launching a run for the presidency. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The U.S. Supreme Court's conservative justices appeared ready to dramatically roll back reproductive rights Wednesday as the court heard oral arguments and a challenge to Mississippi's 15-week abortion ban. The case is being closely watched since it could undermine and possibly overturn the landmark 1973 Roe v. Wade ruling legalizing abortion nationwide. The court's three liberal justices said reversing Roe, or another landmark reproductive rights ruling known as Planned Parenthood versus Casey, would damage the court's legitimacy. This is Justice Sonia Sotomayor.
The sponsors of this bill, the House bill in Mississippi, said we're doing it because we have new justices. The newest ban that Mississippi has put in place, the six-week ban, the Senate sponsor said we're doing it because we have new justices on the Supreme Court. Will this institution survive the stench that this creates in the public perception that the Constitution and its reading are just political acts?
If Roe v. Wade is overturned, almost half of states have so-called trigger laws already in place that will rapidly make abortion illegal. After headlines, we'll have the latest on the fight over reproductive rights at the Supreme Court, analysis of the arguments with Northwestern University law professor Katie Watson and the head of Planned Parenthood, Alexis McGill-Johnson. The United States has for the first time detected a case of the highly mutated Omicron coronavirus variant, which the World Health Organization has labeled a variant of concern. Top infectious disease scientist Dr. Anthony Fauci made the announcement at the White House Wednesday.
We knew that it was just a matter of time before the first case of Omicron would be detected in the United States. The individual was a traveler who returned from South Africa on November the 22nd. And tested positive on November the 29th.
The Omicron variant has now been detected in over two dozen countries. Its discovery in San Francisco prompted the White House to renew calls for Americans to get vaccinated if they haven't already and to get booster shots if eligible. Meanwhile, President Biden's reportedly planning to extend a mask mandate for travelers on planes, trains and buses at airports and transit stations. The mandate was set to expire mid-January, but will now run through at least mid-March. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres Wednesday condemned travel bans imposed by dozens of countries on southern African nations that first detected the Omicron variant, blasting the restrictions as travel apartheid. Guterres noted the virus had already appeared in Europe before it was first detected in Africa and is now in dozens of countries around the world.
The people of Africa cannot be blamed for the immorally low level of vaccinations available to them, nor should they be collectively punished for identifying and sharing crucial science and health information with the world. With a virus that is truly borderless, travel restrictions that isolate any one country or region are not only deeply unfair and punitive, they are ineffective.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken's meeting today with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov amidst mounting tensions between Russia and Ukraine. Russia recently ordered some U.S. diplomats to leave the country. After attending a NATO meeting about the situation Wednesday in Latvia, Secretary of State Antony Blinken warned Russia was planning significant aggressive moves against Ukraine following Moscow's military buildup on the border.
Now, we don't know whether President Putin has made the decision to invade. We do know that he is putting in place the capacity to do so on short order, should he so decide. We've made it clear to the Kremlin that we will respond resolutely, including with a range of high-impact economic measures that we've refrained from using in the past.
Russia has rejected claims of a planned attack against Ukraine. In Burma, local media is reporting thousands of people fled their homes after helicopter attacks in the central Sagaing region, where resistance has remained strong to the military junta, which overthrew the civilian leadership in a February 1st coup. At least seven people were reported dead after weekend air attacks. In related news, the UN has denied for now representation for the military junta at the international body. The UN also denied diplomatic seats to Afghanistan's Taliban leaders. In sports news, the Women's Tennis Association announced it's immediately suspending all tournaments in China because of the, quote, unacceptable response to star tennis player Peng Shuai's accusations of sexual assault against former vice premier Zhang Gaoli. Peng's social media post last month was censored within minutes, and she subsequently disappeared from public view. She's since been seen in videos and photos released by state media, but questions have remained over whether she's acting of her own free will. The International Olympic Committee said they're concerned about the tennis player after speaking with her via video again this week and say they'll meet in person in January. Beijing's hosting the 2022 Winter Olympics. Back in the United States, another victim of Tuesday's shooting at Oxford High School near Detroit has died of their injuries, bringing the death toll to four. Seven other students were injured in the assault. On Wednesday, Oakland County Prosecutor Karen McDonald said she would charge the 15-year-old shooter as an adult and was considering bringing charges against the boy's parents. She said the suspect faces four counts of first-degree murder, seven counts of attempted murder, plus terrorism and weapons charges.
I want to explain why we are charging this suspect as an adult in this case. First, the seriousness of the crime this person committed under Michigan law. There are crimes that the legislature has said are so serious that a person who commits them can automatically be charged as an adult. First-degree murder is the most serious of all those crimes.
In Georgia, Democrat Stacey Abrams has announced she's running for governor in 2022 in a possible rematch of the last election, which Abrams narrowly lost to Republican Brian Kemp. The 2018 race was marred by widespread allegations of voter suppression carried out by Kemp, who refused to step down as Georgia's Secretary of State during the campaign. After her loss, Abrams founded the Fair Fight Political Action Committee, which promotes fair elections and battles Republican Russian voter suppression efforts. Abrams widely credited with helping Joe Biden win Georgia in the 2020 presidential race, while Democrats John Ossoff and Raphael Warnock won U.S. Senate seats there. If elected, Abrams would become the first black woman governor elected in the 245-year history of the United States. Meanwhile, the city of Atlanta has elected a new mayor. Andre Dickens defeated Atlanta City Council President Felicia Moore in a runoff vote that came after outgoing mayor Keisha Lance Bottom said she would not run for a second term. Dickens, who's African-American, has vowed to tackle Atlanta's housing crisis as well as unemployment, racism, and deal with the issue of public safety. The House committee investigating the January 6 Capitol insurrection voted Wednesday night to recommend criminal contempt charges against former Justice Department official Jeffrey Clark for defying a congressional subpoena. But the committee agreed to delay a vote by the full House after Clark agreed to be interviewed again by the January 6 panel. Meanwhile, Wyoming Republican Congressmember Liz Cheney Wednesday warned former President Trump he will face criminal charges if he lies to the committee.
Any communications Mr. Trump has with this committee will be under oath. And if he persists in lying then, he will be accountable under the laws of this great nation and subject to criminal penalties for every false word he speaks.
Congressmember Cheney is among just 10 House Republicans who voted for Trump's impeachment after the Capitol assault. Last month, Wyoming State Republican Party voted to stop recognizing Cheney as a party member, citing her anti-Trump votes. The House of Representatives has overwhelmingly approved a bipartisan bill that would require federal judges to rapidly report stock trades and to make their financial disclosure reports available online. The bill was introduced after the Wall Street Journal found hundreds of lawsuits were overseen by judges involving corporate litigants in which the judges themselves or their families had an ownership stake. A companion bill was introduced in the Senate in October, but has not yet been taken up by the Senate Judiciary Committee. A group of House Democrats is calling on the Justice Department to release environmental and human rights lawyer Stephen Donziger. Donziger's legal team is appealing his six-month prison sentence for contempt of court, which he started in late October. He was convicted of the misdemeanor after a corporate prosecutor tied to the oil and gas industry went after him for successfully taking on Chevron on behalf of indigenous groups and the Ecuadorian Amazon. The private prosecutor has Chevron as one of its clients. Democratic lawmaker spearheaded by Congressmembers Rashida Tlaib and Jesus Chuy Garcia, said in their letter to Attorney General Merrick Garland, the case has, quote, shocked the worldwide community of environmental justice and human rights advocates and creates a distinct chilling effect on this type of advocacy, unquote. Stephen Donziger spoke to Democracy Now! Just hours before he reported to jail.
What's really happening here is Chevron and it's these two judges and really allies of the fossil fuel industry are trying to use me as a weapon to intimidate activists and lawyers who do this work, who do the frontline work of defending the planet. What's at stake, really, I mean, not only my freedom, what's at stake is the ability to advocate for human rights in our society.
You can see all our coverage of this case at democracynow.org. And Major League Baseball's team owners have locked out players after failing to reach a deal on a new collective bargaining agreement before the previous contract officially expired midnight Thursday. It's the ninth labor stoppage in Major League history and the first since a player strike in 1994. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. When we come back, the Supreme Court appears set to uphold Mississippi's 15-week abortion ban, a move that could undermine or overturn the landmark Roe v. Wade decision. We'll hear excerpts from Wednesday's oral arguments and speak to Professor Katie Watson and Planned Parenthood of America Chief Alexis McGill Johnson. Stay with us.
I'm my brother's keeper every chance I can. And I pay my taxes like a working man. And I feel I've earned my right to choose. You don't get to play God, man. I do. You don't get to play God, man. I do. You get
Pray God by Ani DiFranco. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Nermeen Sheikh. Hi, Nermeen.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Well, in the biggest challenge to abortion rights in half a century, the Supreme Court's conservative majority Wednesday indicated they support upholding a restrictive Mississippi abortion law that bans abortion starting at 15 weeks of pregnancy. The ruling could undermine and possibly overturn the landmark 1973 Roe v. Wade ruling legalizing abortion nationwide. The court, with its 6-3 conservative majority, heard about 2 hours of oral arguments. Justice Amy Coney Barrett suggested, while questioning Julie Rickleman, the lawyer representing Jackson Women's Health Organization, that so-called safe haven laws that allow mothers to relinquish parental rights mean they cannot be forced into motherhood.
You and many of your amici focus on the ways in which the forced parenting, forced motherhood, would hinder women's access to the workplace and to equal opportunities. It's also focused on the consequences of parenting and the obligations of motherhood that flow from pregnancy. Why don't the safe haven laws take care of that problem?
Meanwhile, Justice Brett Kavanaugh raised the issue of legal precedents, which he also addressed during his 2018 confirmation hearing when he was asked about his views on the Supreme Court's abortion rulings. This is Kavanaugh back in 2018 suggesting Roe v. Wade is settled law and unlikely to be overturned.
One of the important things to keep in mind about Roe v. Wade is that it has been reaffirmed many times over the past 45 years, as you know. And most prominently, most importantly, reaffirmed in Planned Parenthood versus Casey in 1992.
So that's Judge Kavanaugh in 2018 at his confirmation hearing, referring to the Supreme Court's 1992 ruling in Planned Parenthood versus Casey, which reaffirmed Roe. His comments were cited by Republican Senator Susan Collins when she provided the pivotal vote to confirm Kavanaugh to the high court, even though she is pro-choice. But during Wednesday's oral arguments, Justice Kavanaugh made what seemed to be a much different argument about precedent.
If you think about some of the most important cases, the most consequential cases in this court's history, there's a string of them where the cases overruled precedent. Brown v. Board outlawed separate but equal. Baker versus Carr, which set the stage for one person, one vote. West Coast Hotel, which recognized the state's authority to regulate business. Miranda versus Arizona, which required police to give warnings when the right to about the right to remain silent and to have an attorney present to suspects in criminal custody. Lawrence v. Texas, which said that the state may not prohibit same-sex conduct. Knapp versus Ohio, which held that the exclusionary rule applies to state criminal prosecutions to exclude evidence obtained in violation of the Fourth Amendment. Gideon versus Wainwright, which guaranteed the right to counsel in criminal cases. Obergefell, which recognized a constitutional right to same-sex marriage.
So that's Justice Kavanaugh yesterday. Meanwhile, the High Court's three liberal justices said reversing Roe and Casey would damage the court's legitimacy. This is Justice Sonia Sotomayor.
There has been some difference of opinion with respect to undue burden, but the right of a woman to choose, the right of to control her own body, has been clearly set for since Casey and never challenged. You want us to reject that line of viability and adopt something different. 15 justices over 50 years have, or I should say 30 since Casey, reaffirmed that basic viability line. Four have said no, two of them members of this court, but 15 justices have said yes, of varying political backgrounds.
Now, the sponsors of this bill, the House bill in Mississippi, said we're doing it because we have new justices. The newest ban that Mississippi has put in place, the six-week ban, the Senate sponsor said, we're doing it because we have new justices on the Supreme Court. Will this institution survive the stench that this creates in the public perception that the Constitution and its reading are just political acts?
That is Justice Sonia Sotomayor. If Roe v. Wade is overturned, almost half of states have so-called trigger laws already in place that will rapidly make abortion illegal. For more, we're joined by Katie Watson, bioethics professor at Northwestern University Feinberg School of Medicine. She's a lawyer and author of the book Scarlet A, The Ethics, Law, and Politics of Ordinary Abortion. Professor Watson, welcome to Democracy Now! There is so much to unpack here. If you can talk about what you found most significant and alarming about what took place in the U.S. Supreme Court on Wednesday.
Most alarming and most saddening is that the court is on the brink of making a grave error that will put it on the wrong side of history. And I say that for two reasons. If the court is to gut or overturn Roe v. Wade, that will hurt all American women, not just those seeking abortion. And I think that's a point that we haven't quite captured. And second, it will bankrupt the moral authority of the institution itself, the institutional legitimacy concerns you heard in those recordings. As Justice Breyer said, the court doesn't have an army or a purse. It has its credibility, and it's on the brink of losing it.
And Professor Watson, could you explain what the origins of this case are, the Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization? What's the history of the case?
Yes, thank you, Noreen. Mississippi has a long history of trying to restrict abortion rights, and in this statute, it banned abortion after 15 weeks. And what is so striking about this statute is Mississippi didn't even bother to come up with a fake science rationale for why 15 weeks was better than the viability standard. The statute itself simply says abortion after 15 weeks is barbaric. What's barbaric, in my opinion, is forced childbearing. So they randomly have picked a lower number and moved forward with that. And in the almost 50-year history of Roe, lower courts at the district and appellate level just strike laws like that because they're so obviously contradictory to Roe and Casey, the 1990 Duke case that affirmed the core holding of Roe. And in this situation, the Supreme Court granted certiorari, what they will hear the case, which was shocking. Usually they would just rubber stamp it. And on the question, do all pre-viability bans on, quote, elective abortion violate the Constitution? They don't accept that question or say they'll hear arguments on that question unless they think they have five members who think the answer is yes. Now, Justice Roberts called out the Solicitor General of Mississippi, and I think appropriately so, to say, we granted cert on this question about the number. Could states ban abortion before viability? Your brief primarily argues we should overturn Roe versus Wade, which is not what we granted cert on. And so you can see this is really a false conversation, a Trojan horse, if you will, these number conversations about gestational age for overturning Roe, because opponents of legal abortion and women's personhood know that the viability standard is central to Roe. It's the only principled gestational age standard there is. And so if they can get movement on that, they've disassembled Roe.
Professor Watson, explain what the viability standard is and its origins in abortion law in the U.S., and also trigger laws, where they exist and what that would mean.
So the viability standard, there are two pieces of it that I think are often confusing to people. So I'm delighted to explain it. The first part is that the Roe court did not decide that a fetus is a person or has any protection after viability. It said that there's no possible way that the framers in the 16 uses of the word person in the Constitution could have been thinking about embryos or fetuses. What's not in dispute is that women are people under the Constitution. So it said that women have a constitutional right to continue or end pregnancy as they see fit until this medical moment called viability. And the court used general phrasing to explain what that is. So think of cruel and unusual punishment or other constitutional standards that use words instead of specifics and numbers. They said that viability was a reasonable chance at a meaningful life. And the medical profession, and they left it to the medical profession to decide what that was and when that happened. But in the Roe opinion, they said today that happens at generally at 28 weeks and often as early as 24 weeks. So people have this idea that there's just been, and there has been progress in NICU medicine for sure, but not the astronomical progress that it's sometimes painted as, because today at about 24 weeks, if a person who's continuing a pregnancy goes into premature labor, there's somewhere around the ballpark of a 50% chance of survival of that fetus, maybe a little higher these days, and often with significant or moderate disability. So the medical profession has pegged it there. There's no problem with the viability standard because it moves with medicine. The significant thing about the viability standard is that it's the only principled standard, to use the term of Julie Rickelman, who argued the case, and I've argued this in my book, because it is the only gestational or developmental standard that accounts for the pregnant person. It's the only one that acknowledges the person in whom that embryo or fetus lives and is dependent on. So what the court did in Roe very wisely is to say, essentially, well, the biological goal of pregnancy is to deliver an independent person, a baby. And so at the point of development, when at least theoretically that fetus could live separately with medical support from the person in whom it lives, that's when the state can assert an interest in potential life.
So I want to go to the exchange from Wednesday's oral arguments between Supreme Court Justice John Roberts and Julie Rickelman, a litigation director of Center for Reproductive Rights.
If you think that the issue is one of choice, that women should have a choice to terminate their pregnancy, that supposes that there is a point at which they've had the fair choice, opportunity to choice. And why would 15 weeks be an inappropriate line? So a viability, it seems to me, doesn't have anything to do with choice. But if it really is an issue about choice, why is 15 weeks not enough time?
For a few reasons, Your Honor. First, the state has conceded that some women will not be able to obtain an abortion before 15 weeks, and this law will bar them from doing so. And a reasonable possibility standard would be completely unworkable for the courts. It would be both less principled and less workable than viability. And some of the reasons for that are, without viability, there will be no stopping point. States will rush to ban abortion at virtually any point in pregnancy. Mississippi itself has a six-week ban that it's defending with very similar arguments as it's using to defend the 15-week ban, and there are states that have bans.
Well, I know, but I'd like to focus on the 15-week ban, because that's not a dramatic departure from viability. It is the standard that the vast majority of other countries have. When you get to the viability standard, we share that standard with the People's Republic of China and North Korea. And I don't think you have to be in favor of looking to international law to set our constitutional standards to be concerned if those are your share that particular time period.
That's Chief Justice John Roberts questioning Julie Rickleman. If you can talk, Professor Watson, about the fact that this is the Roberts Court and the particular significance of him raising this, and then we'll go to Kavanaugh on neutrality, so-called neutrality of the court.
What Justice Roberts is missing is several things. The first is, I hate to just start with simple math, but 15 weeks is 9 weeks less than 24. And recall that the way pregnancy is dated, the 0 to 2 weeks, you're not really pregnant since most people ovulate in the middle of the month. So that's 40% less time to discover your pregnancy and then take the action necessary if you choose to end your pregnancy. So it's not insignificant. The other piece is conceptual. As I explained earlier, there is a principled basis for the viability line. There is no principled basis for 15 weeks. So that should be very important to Justice Roberts, although it sounds like it's not. The true weakness of the Roe case, honestly, is its assertion of a state interest in potential life at viability with absolutely no analysis or justification. What would justify the state's interest in an entity that is not a person? An interest in more taxpayers, an interest in creating more soldiers. There's no explanation why at any point the potential interest of a fetus or the state's interest in that fetus, Roe gave fetuses no rights, would supersede the actual person in whom it lives. So John Roberts is wrong about the math. He's wrong about the principle. And he's also wrong about international law in his comparison. He cited it incorrectly, as Rickleman pointed out. But the even more important comparison is context. For example, in Europe, where they have national health care and people don't have to pay for their abortions or pay for their contraception in the same way we do here, and a different system of sex education where people have awareness of pregnancy in a different way than they do perhaps in Mississippi schools, that you can't compare the two in terms of abortion rates, how early people find out, and their quicker access to health care. Those who are concerned about later abortion more than earlier abortion, the best policy measure they could support is to have Medicaid coverage in America, repeal the Hyde Amendment, and allow poor women, low-income women are 75% of abortion patients, make it easier for them to get to the doctor faster.
Kavanaugh, let's go to let's go to Justice Brett Kavanaugh and his line of questions about neutrality to Mississippi Solicitor General Scott Stewart.
You're arguing that the Constitution's silent and therefore neutral on the question of abortion. In other words, that the Constitution's neither pro-life nor pro-choice on the question of abortion, but leaves the issue for the people of the states or perhaps Congress to resolve in the democratic process. Is that accurate?
Right. We're saying it's left to the people, Your Honor.
And so for the if you were to prevail, the states, majority of states, or states still could or and presumably would continue to freely allow abortion. Many states, some states, would be able to do that even if you prevail under your view. Is that correct?
That's consistent with our view, Your Honor. It's one that allows all interests to have full voice, and many of the abortions we see in certain states that I don't think anybody would think would be moving to change their laws in a more restrictive direction.
So, Professor Katie Watson, if you can respond and the significance of this issue of so-called neutrality and Kavanaugh asserting, let the states decide. That's letting the people decide.
This is such a dramatic and I think insincere error. The idea of neutrality, you could substitute the word segregation in everything he said. The Constitution is silent on segregation. The Constitution is silent on contraception. The Constitution is silent on interracial marriage. You know, you could gay marriage. You could substitute all sorts of concepts there. And as he said later, you know, California and New York will do one thing, and the people of Mississippi and Arkansas will do something different. We've heard that before. Fundamental rights are not something you're supposed to have to beg for at the polls at every election cycle. And so when he says the Constitution is neutral on abortion, What he is hiding is that the Constitution is not neutral on the personhood of women, right? And so to claim this false neutrality is to throw all American women under the bus. So that he cited Plessy versus Ferguson and Brown versus Board of Education as one of the cases. Plessy was reversed by Brown. And I would like to use his own analogy to help illustrate how wrong he is. When I said earlier that all American women are harmed by what the court is on the brink of doing, gutting the viability, gutting Roe by jettisoning the viability standard or potentially overruling the case. In Plessy versus Ferguson, the court, in a case of segregated railways in Louisiana, a state that just chose to do something different, that the court said, it's not a badge of inferiority to have segregation. If African-Americans feel that way, basically that's their problem. And in Brown, they said, no, segregation, separate is never equal. So in this case, whether you are a lesbian, whether you are a postmenopausal woman who is infertile, whether you are a nun, it has no bearing on whether you are fertile and at risk of accidental pregnancy. The symbolic violence, the badge of inferiority, to say the Constitution is neutral on whether a state can commandeer your body and force you to produce a child against your will, to say the Constitution is neutral on that, is to tell all women that the Supreme Court, our Constitution, and many states see you first and foremost as a baby machine and do not trust or defer to your intellect and your moral agency to make a good and right decision. That is a badge of inferiority.
We want to thank you for being with us. Katie Watson, bioethics professor at Northwestern University Feinberg School of Medicine, lawyer and author of Scarlet A, The Ethics, Law, and Politics of Ordinary Abortion. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh as we look at how the Supreme Court appears set to uphold Mississippi's 15-week abortion ban in a move that could either radically reduce abortion access in much of the country or to overturn Roe v. Wade entirely. Bringing into this discussion Alexis McGill Johnson, president and CEO of the Planned Parenthood Federation of America and the Planned Parenthood Action Fund. Thank you for coming back on Democracy Now!, Alexis. When Amy Coney Barrett talked about women should not be forced to be mothers, after all, they could give up the children after the infant was born. Can you comment on this new Handmaid's Tale version of America?
Amy, first, it's good to be with you today. You know, listening to Justice Amy Coney Barrett talk about adoption or safe haven as the solution to abortion, as opposed to just a different outcome of pregnancy, really, I thought just was undermining. It was offensive. The very equality and liberty that Julie Rickleman was so forcefully arguing in the court today, that our very right to determine when and if we become pregnant, our self-determination is predicated on our ability to be seen as free and equal citizens in this country. And I just thought that the road that Justice Barrett went down was quite alarming and really quite shocking.
Alexis, could you explain who you think would be most impacted? Who are the women, the demographics of the women who most commonly receive abortions in the U.S.? Professor Watson mentioned that 75% of them are a low income.
Yes, absolutely. Look, I mean, we're seeing this actually play out right now in Texas, the impact that we are seeing on our patients, on patients of independent providers who have to flee the state in order to gain access to this constitutional right. They are going to be more likely to be low income, Black, Brown, Indigenous communities, people who are trans and non-binary, people who may not have support at home. And the impact of what we are saying, right, that if the court is so willing not only to ban abortion at 15 weeks, but also, as they seem poised to do, consider overturning 50 years of precedent, we could see 26 states move in the same vein. And that would affect 36 million people. So we are talking about people who have the least, you know, ability to be forced into pregnancy, to be forced into poverty, and the impact and the significant burden that it would put on them to seek services outside of their state is alarming.
And Alexis, could you explain how many, because the what's at issue here is 15 weeks, how many abortions, what percentage do you know occur after 15 weeks?
Look, the great majority abortions do happen under 20 weeks, and the great majority abortions also happen to people who are already parents, who understand what becoming a parent to an additional child means for their lives and for their families. And so, you know, I think what was happening in the court yesterday, particularly by the Mississippi Solicitor General, was the Mississippi was asking for a world where states get to determine who is free and who is not. You know, that this whole argument around, a state particularly like Mississippi, one that has the highest maternal mortality rate, the highest infant mortality rate, and is the lowest among child well-being, those are the folks that are going to be the most impacted by these kinds of decisions. And the majority of them, as I said, don't happen after the 15-week.
So, Alexis McGill-Johnson, as we wrap up, let's look into the future here. We don't exactly need a crystal ball. But if essentially Roe v. Wade were so undermined or overturned by the Supreme Court, how these trigger laws in about half states will impact abortion availability in the country? Planned Parenthood has hundreds of clinics around the country.
Yeah, yes, Planned Parenthood has hundreds of clinics. There are also a number of independent providers that are in the South and the Midwest, where these trigger bans and laws will take effect. You know, it will, as I said, we've seen playing out in Texas right now. We're seeing people in Texas having to travel thousands of miles to New Mexico, to California, to Oregon, to New York, to Vermont, just to get access to, determine their own future. And so we are putting a tremendous burden on people to move out of state and gain access to abortion. And, you know, again, it is going to impact the people who can least afford the ability to move out of state as well.
Well, Alexis McGill-Johnson, we thank you so much for being with us, President and CEO of the Planned Parenthood Federation of America and Planned Parenthood Action Fund. Next up, we go to France, where the American-born pioneering performer and civil rights icon Josephine Baker has been inducted into the Pantheon at the same time racism is on the rise in France. And the far-right xenophobic writer Eric Zemmour, who many describe as a fascist, has launched a run for the presidency. Stay with us. J'ai deux amours, I have two loves, by Josephine Baker. The song was played at the Pantheon in Paris during her induction ceremony Tuesday. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. French President Emmanuel Macron has inducted the American-born pioneering performer and civil rights icon Josephine Baker into the Pantheon, considered France's highest tribute. She's the first Black woman, first American to receive the honor. Josephine Baker was born in St. Louis in 1906. As an 11-year-old, she witnessed racial violence firsthand when white mobs attacked East St. Louis, Illinois, killing as many as 150 Black residents. At the age of 19, she moved to France to escape racism at home. Soon, she became a superstar on stage and screen. In 1951, she returned to the U.S. on tour, refused to play for segregated audiences, was later banned from re-entering the United States for a decade after being accused of having ties to the Communist Party. In 1963, she flew in from Paris to speak at the March on Washington, the only woman. Josephine Baker died in 1975, but her legacy lives on. The induction ceremony for Josephine Baker comes at a time when racism is on the rise in France. Earlier this week, the far-right xenophobic writer and pundit Eric Zemmour announced he would run for president in April's election. He's been described as, quote, the most extreme voice of French racism today. Zemmour had repeatedly attacked Islam, immigrants, and the left. He's been charged numerous times with inciting racial hatred, including after he called unaccompanied child migrants thieves, killers, and rapists. Some analysts have described him as the French Donald Trump. We go now to France, where we're joined by French journalist and filmmaker Rokhaya Diallo. Her latest op-ed for The Washington Post is headlined, Josephine Baker Enters the Pantheon. Don't let it distract from this larger story. Thanks so much for joining us, Rokhaya. Why don't you start off by telling us that larger story and then go into the significance of Josephine Baker being recognized.
Yes, so thank you so much for inviting me. I'm very happy. To me, it's a very good news to finally have a woman of color in the Pantheon, which is, like, as you said, the highest, like one of the most prestigious place to welcome the most revered French figures. So it's something that is very meaningful because she, as well as being an entertainer, and she was also a hero resisting during the Second World War, but also took part to the March on Washington. As you said, she was the first, the only woman. But the thing is that there are two things that left me with mixed feelings. First, the fact that France tends to use the fact that it has been very welcoming to African Americans throughout the 20th century to picture itself as a very open and welcoming country. But the thing that we tend to forget is that while Josephine Baker was celebrated and dancing on Parisian stages, France was a very violent colonial power. So it was also colonizing Africa and Asia and also the Caribbean. And perpetrating very, very much violence to people who were colonized, and also displaying them in what was called at that time the colonial exhibitions, which were basically human zoos where you could see people coming from the colony to be seen by visitors from Paris and from other regions of France. So there was a double standard with African American being welcomed because they were American and didn't have any historical agreement to settle with France, and at the same time, other people of color who were actually submitted to the French state.
And Rokhaya, if you could elaborate on that a bit, I'd just like to read a short quotation from the acclaimed writer James Baldwin, who was, of course, one of the most prominent African Americans to seek a refuge in France. He wrote about precisely this issue in an interview, he said, in 1983, in France, I am a Black American posing no conceivable threat to French identity. In effect, I do not exist in France. I might have a very different tale to tell were I from Senegal and a very bitter song to sing were I from Algeria. Rokhaya Diallo, your comments.
Yes, it's very interesting because it's still the same today. if you are a black person from the U.S., you're mostly seen as American. And the identity, the American identity, is very prestigious, and it has nothing to do with the French colonialism. So you don't really take part to that sense of guilt or to that confrontational relationship that you may have had with France, because your ancestors were not the victims of the French racism. So you're seen as someone who doesn't have to do with the national context, and you even benefit from the fact that you have now today many African Americans who are very famous. So you have that very positive image. And actually, that's just, I feel the same way when I go to the U.S. because I'm French, and I'm seen as a French person. So as when people understand that I'm not African American, I'm suddenly seen as someone that is connected to a country that is very prestigious, that has to do with fashion, with the art de vivre, and such and so. And I no longer have to deal with all the racial issues that are really connected to the African American identity. And James Baldwin is always used in the French public discourse as an example of France not being as racist as the U.S., which is, to me, not true. But that tells a lot about how that myth, that is very vivid also in the U.S. context, of the French being open-minded, is still alive, which is not the case because, you know, I was born and raised in France, but my parents were born in Senegal, and they were born with the indigenous status, which was a status that was less than the status of citizen. So at the time, when Josephine Baker was celebrated, my own ancestors, my grandparents, my, you know, great-grandparents did not have the same opportunities. So if she was a black woman from Africa or from Guadeloupe or from Martinique, she wouldn't have had the same opportunities. And I think it's important to say that. I think we need to celebrate the fact that she's finally recognized, but that should not erase the fact that at the same time, France was not open to minorities, and it was very violent, and it really took part to wars to prevent those people from gaining their freedom and from standing for their own humanity.
Rukaya, explain also, you said that these issues persist today. How does this kind of racism manifest itself broadly within French society, but also specifically with respect to its immigration policies?
You just mentioned the fact that Éric Zemmour, the pundit, the former pundit who is now running for presidency, was made his fame on racist statements and also sexist statements. His obsessions are mostly directed toward immigration and Islam. When he said publicly, officially, that he would run for presidency, was invited to a TV show, and he said that it doesn't make any difference between Islam and Islamism, so extremism. And he said that, according to him, Muslims from France should how do you say that in English? They should not be Muslim anymore. They should drop their religion, actually. So that means that, you can say that publicly and run for presidency and having many people decided to vote for you. So to me, it's, and at the same time, his stance is very aggressive toward immigration. And there is also in the government of Emmanuel Macron, there is, a very open anti-immigrant discourse. They voted a law against immigration 3 years ago, which was one of the worst laws since the Second World War. So, you know, celebrating Josephine Baker, who was an immigrant, who decided to leave her country because she wanted to live a better life elsewhere, is while making things difficult for immigrants of today to access to France, is a contradiction to me, because maybe today Emmanuel Macron is preventing the future Josephine Bakers from coming to France because the barriers to come here are higher and higher. So there is a kind of ambivalence because while celebrating Josephine Baker who was a celebrity during the last century. Today, racism is still alive. It's still expressing itself against immigrants, but also against all people of colors, for example, in police brutality, in police. We have statistics that says that if you are seen as a black man or an Arab man, you are 20 times more likely to be checked. Randomly in the streets by the police than if you belong to any other category. So that means that you have that experience of a person of color in France facing systemic racism, facing institutional racism, and at the same time, a president that celebrates a woman of color who stood against racism, but she stood against racism in the U.S. She never actually said anything against colonization or against racism in France because the life that she had in France made her be grateful. And I understand why she was grateful, but it's very convenient to celebrate someone that has nothing to say against France.
Rukaya Diallo, in talking about Eric Zemmour and what kind of threat he represents, can you talk about the role of the media? I mean, hasn't he been tried and convicted for hate speech several times? And what does that mean?
It's funny that you asked the question because the first time he was convicted for hate speech, it was because of a debate we had. He was facing me. So Eric Zemmour has been created by the media. He's been like the first book that made him mainstream was a very violent book against women, against feminism, against the fact that women are gaining more and more space, more and more rights. And then he became a pundit on the public television. It was not even a private television. And he stayed after being convicted, he remained public. He remained on the public television and then on other private media. So to me, there is much complicity from the media because they knew who he was. They knew that they were more interested by the buzz, by the noise around his statements, than by the fact of being fair and not perpetrating, not echoing hate speeches. So actually, to me, there is much complicity to all the people that gave him a mic who amplified his voice, because they gave him the platform to make him able running for presidency and just polluting the atmosphere with like hate speech, with racist statements, with sexist statements, and harassing basically people of color by constantly having aggressive words against them.
Rukaya, could you explain what you think his actual prospects are as a presidential candidate? And just to give very quickly some of the statements that you say have been amplified, he's approved of people comparing Islam with Nazism, said that parents should only give their children traditional French names, advanced the great replacement theory, and said that political power should be with men and not women, whose role it is to have and raise children.
Yes, he said that actually women are unable to be geniuses and to be politicians because to him they don't have like that ability to do. And he said that without consequence. He also just lately he was facing a woman, a Muslim woman with a hijab, with a headscarf in the street, and he asked her to remove her headscarf in order to be truly French. And I remember he told me during the same debate that my first name, Rukaya, wasn't truly French, and that my parents should have named me differently to make me Frencher. So that was so offensive, that was so aggressive, and I don't understand why people didn't challenge him more directly. And now he's just
we have 10 seconds.
He's just saying whatever he wants without facing real criticize and deep criticize. And I think that that will be difficult because he's more provocative than Marine Le Pen, who is the head of the current far right, the National Rally.
We want to thank you so much, Rekaya, for joining us. Rekaya Diallo, French journalist, writer and filmmaker, contributing writer for The Washington Post, will link to her piece, Josephine Baker Enters the Pantheon. Don't let it distract from this larger story. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Stay safe.